As the anniversary of September 11th draws near, many are preparing for a day of vigils, memorials, and other expressions of mourning. Grief is a deep part of our culture. Just outside Philadelphia is the Museum of Mourning Arts. NPR's Netta Ulaby recently visited the museum.
The Museum of Mourning Arts fills a couple thousand square feet with beautiful objects that tell devastating stories of heartbreak and melancholy. It's all immaculately clean and arranged in orderly fashion. Facing you almost reproachfully as you walk in is a huge reproduction of a Northern Renaissance engraving. It shows a distraught woman, her head buried in her hands, a starving dog at her feet. Anita Schorsch runs the museum. She says the Renaissance was characterized not just by sublime music and art, but also typhoid, tuberculosis, and plague. Death and art went hand in hand.
The art of mourning was to prepare people for a death, and the art of mourning was also to encourage an idealized vision of the person who died.
Schorsch became interested in mourning art as a graduate student in literature. She and her husband built the museum in 1990. Appropriately, it's attached to a funeral home. The rooms are dimly lit and glass cases line the walls. They're filled with 400-year-old instruction books on how to get into heaven.
This is an emblem book where the skeleton is chopping away at a tree, which is obviously dead because it has no leaves. And little tiny heads, skeletons' heads, are flying up into heaven.
That wouldn't strike most of us as a reassuring image, but Schorsch says it's symbolically loaded with spiritual enlightenment. And it made sense to a readership wrecked by immeasurable mortality rates.
And if you couldn't read, you could always look at pictures and understand, which is the purpose of emblem books, to have messages sent out to people so that they could live well and die well, and have a soul that could then live on in eternity.
These books, Schorsch says, furnish not only guidance, but also comfort. And they preserve an aesthetic that's all but vanished. Artists not only knew what the soul looked like, but they knew exactly where to find it.
It lived in either the skull or in the thigh bone, which are in fact the skull and crossbones, which we think of as pirates, and we think of it as poison. But originally, those two bones were the seat of the soul because that was where regeneration and creativity came from.
To have a good death, you had to live a good life. Schorsch points out some colorful broadsides published in Pennsylvania in the 1700s and meant to hang on living room walls. They prescribe the stages of a person's life and the wages of sin. You see heaven in these pictures, but not much of it. It's an elegant city or placid village crammed into a thin strip on the top of the page. And it's crowded out by hell.
Hell is out here in society. There's a hotel over there, and there are things going on upstairs which shouldn't be going on. There is Dr. Quack and the abortionist. It's a man and woman couple who are trying to intrigue people. There's the harlot over there, drinking going on over here, and the poor ministers are standing trying to get someone to be willing to go into heaven.
Schorsch says the art of mourning really took off in 1799, when George Washington died. The country was suddenly awash in mourning wreaths, paintings, prints, kerchiefs, crockery, and samplers.
And over here is something which is relatively new to the museum. These are funeral invitations.
These date from the 1800s. They look like high society wedding invitations on ivory paper, except instead of brides and blossoms, they picture tombstones, corpses, and funeral processions.
And in this one, you have women dressed in white. These art forms tell you something. This was a chaste person who had died, and that's why they were wearing white.
And the performance of sorrow became an art form in itself. Schorsch says that elaborate 19th century mourning rituals got a boost from Queen Victoria.
After her prince died, she wore mourning clothes for the rest of her life, including to the wedding of one of her girls. She never left them off.
Mannequins draped in widow's weeds loom against a wall. Wealthy widows commonly wore dull black with no ornaments for a year. Then they gradually and discreetly added ribbons, shiny fabrics, and colors like gray and lavender. Another Victorian vogue was mourning jewelry. Schorsch points to rows of narrow gold bands and pearly porcelain brooches. They don't look unusual until you peer at them closely. Then you see the tiny pictures of skeletons, angels, and people long dead. Robin Jaffe Frank is an expert on these miniature portraits.
Dissolved hair and chopped hair and even sometimes long strands of hair would be incorporated because hair, since it survives time and decay, is used in rituals of love and loss the world over.
These lockets, rings, and brooches with hair added a literal dimension to the idea of carrying a loved one close to the heart.
Having such a potent, tangible token of someone you love was very powerful and was understood at the time by the community as a shared way of mourning.
As our contemporary communities grope for ways of dealing with human loss, Frank says perhaps a better sense of ritual might make us feel less alienated. Anita Schorsch believes that the Museum of Mourning Arts has a simple reminder to its visitors to live a good life.
I guess the Mourning Art Museum is just a show or sign of people trying to be civil at a terrible time in their lives.
And with civility and ritual comes consolation. Netta Ulibi, NPR News, Washington.